The fact of the matter is that it is still difficult for women in leadership.
Welcome to this interview series, Behind the Numbers on Women in Peacemaking. My name is Martin Bielisch from the United Nations Department of Political and Peacebuilding Affairs in New York City. In this episode, together with my colleague Minji Song, we interviewed Hannah Tette, the UN's representative to the African Union. Our talk with Ms. Tette sheds light on her personal story as a woman in leadership positions, including as Foreign Minister of Ghana and as co-facilitator in the peace process of South Sudan. Heading the United Nations Office to the African Union since 2018, she explains in this interview how the UN has been amplifying women voices across Africa. Enjoy listening to this episode.
This is Hannah Tette for DPPA, Behind the Numbers.
Thank you so much for your time to speak to us today. We wanted to start with asking you about challenges for women in senior positions. There's the famous saying that women hold up half the sky. And at the same time, as you noted in another interview some time ago, when you were Foreign Minister of Ghana, women in leadership need to prove themselves every day. And we were wondering whether this has become easier or harder nowadays.
The fact of the matter is that it is still difficult for women in leadership, because you feel the need to continuously be able to demonstrate that you are capable and you do understand what is expected of you and you are doing your best to make sure that you and your team are delivering. But having said that, I do think that the increased advocacy within the UN and the support of the Secretary General to have gender parity at the senior leadership levels, but also to extend that further within the organization, has created the space for many more women within the United Nations to assume senior leadership positions. On the African continent, it's a bit more mixed in terms of outcomes. There are some countries where women have made great progress in leadership and have been appointed to senior positions. And that is, for instance, with Rwanda, recently with Ethiopia. But when it comes to issues of peace and security, and especially when you are dealing with negotiations among political actors, unless it is explicitly stated that women should be part of the teams that are going to be present and active in the negotiation, the tendency is not to include women. So I think there's still quite a lot of work to be done, but at least I can say that we are making slow progress.
Thank you, Hannah. We wanted to go back to the beginning of your career. You studied law, worked as a barrister, and became Member of Parliament. Who were your role models, including women, that motivated you to enter local politics and then eventually now work for the United Nations?
Well, I wasn't inspired to enter politics by a woman. I was inspired to enter politics by a man, and that was my father. But having said that, when I won election and I entered into parliament, there were a number of colleagues who had previously been members of parliament and therefore had experience and who were very willing to share that experience with me. And I benefited from their wisdom and from their insights. And then further on in my career, as I was a member of government and subsequently when I joined the United Nations, I would say that within the United Nations, there's been a greater support group of women in leadership, if you like. And it's not a formal support group. It's very much an informal group, but it has been beneficial to have colleagues who are dealing with similar challenges, who also have had the experience of working within this organization longer, and who you can refer to or who you can ask if there are any questions or any concerns you have about the way in which you should best handle situations as they are unfolding. So I think that has been, perhaps for me, the benefit of being part of an organization like the United Nations. But if I go back to my career, and as I was speaking, I just remembered, when I happened to be Foreign Minister of Ghana and Madame Zuma was the chair of the African Union, one of the things that she did, which I thought was, at the time, it was certainly an opportunity for those of us who happen to be part of that, if you like, very informal network, was that she would always reach out to the female foreign ministers and make sure that she caught up with us in between meetings and discussions, just to find out from us what we thought about the issues that were on the table for discussion and how we thought that we could best deal with those issues to put together a perspective that would be acceptable to the rest of the continent. And it was, again, interesting to have that experience because Madame Zuma, of course, has had a very long and diverse experience in politics in South Africa. And one of the things that she used to say was that let's make a distinction between strategy and tactics and not confuse strategy and tactics and focus on the short-term goal, but at the same time, look at the longer-term objective we want to achieve and how best to go about it. And this was very much the case when she was discussing with us the Agenda 2063 for the Africa we want. So, yes, there have been a few female mentors, but as I'm sure many women have found out for themselves, very often this is a path you walk alone.
Thank you. The insights you shared on this informal support network among UN women in senior positions is very interesting. It contrasts the so-called boys' clubs that exist. And before I hand over to my colleague Minji, I was wondering whether you can tell us more about it. What are questions, issues, or themes you discuss with peers and other women in that context?
What it is that we are able to call on each other, and we are also able to discuss issues when we have challenges in the way in which we relate to, the difficulties in which we find ourselves sometimes as regards the delivery of our mandates, but at the same time in the way in which we interact with other colleagues within the UN. This is a very complex bureaucracy. And even if you've known about it from the outside, it's never quite the same as actually working and being part of the UN as an establishment. And so when there is the opportunity to be able to touch base with others and find out, you know, this is what it is and this is what I've been tasked to do and this is what it is, this is the challenge that we are facing, or this is the ongoing political discussion within this context, or this is the challenge with this particular process which we are trying to mediate or push forward, and to hear what they have to say, it's quite helpful because, again, you get the benefits of other experiences and different perspectives.
Thank you, Martin and Hannah. This is great. It's so wonderful to hear about the enabling factors within the UN. I wonder whether we can now turn to active mediation processes and the opportunities of the WPS agenda, and especially your leadership in political and peace processes. So I want to start with a concrete example. In your role as co-facilitator of the revitalized agreement on the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan in 2017, how did you engage with national actors to ensure active participation of women in the process?
Well, when we started that process, it was quite formal in the sense that the mediation sessions were held here in Addis Ababa, and the various stakeholders that had been invited to be part of the mediation had been requested to ensure that women were part of their delegations. So it wasn't optional, it was mandatory. Now, you could see that in some delegations, there were women who were very active and who were very engaged, and there were other delegations where that was not the case. And so you had the impression that maybe the selection was done in a way to ensure that they met the criteria that had been set by IGAD as the main facilitator of the process. But when we actually got started in the discussions, I always made sure that I created enough of an opportunity for women to be also able to raise their issues and not just the issues of their male counterparts. And when they raised their issues and they were dismissed, and I felt that their responses were inadequate, I would ask questions to compel a response. For instance, there was a statement made by a young woman from civil society who indicated that there were a number of women who had been sexually abused and violated by members of the various armed factions, and especially from the SPLA and the Sudanese Defense Forces. And I remember that one of the ministers said that, no, that was not the case. And for that matter, whenever such things happened, the people were brought to justice and they were tried and the law had taken its course. And then, you know, she came up again and she said, but that's not correct because there have been so many cases where this has not happened and people have been able to get away with impunity. And then he came back on that point and I told him that, you know something, given that this is such a serious concern in South Sudan, if indeed you had been holding people to account, everybody would know about it. It would be an issue that would be on the media and social media. The fact that only you seem to know that this is what is happening suggests to me that this is not the case. Can you be a bit more explicit in your answer? And if not, then let's put it out as one of the issues that this is something that must be dealt with and people must be held accountable for sexual misconduct because it cannot continue like this. And I remember the look on her face when she saw me putting the issues to him in that manner and his inability to respond. And after we had finished the session, I heard somebody running behind me and, I turned around and there was this young lady and the way she wrapped her arms around me, she almost made me fall down. And it was one of those moments where you felt, well, at the time, I didn't realize just how much it would mean to someone like her. But afterwards, and the way in which a number of the women reacted when they saw that, you know, when they were raising issues, I made it a point to put it to their various other representatives and then to insist that they respond or to insist that provisions to deal with those issues were put into the agreement for the revitalized agreement, that it was something that they were waiting for, that they needed somebody to give them the platform to do that. And I remember also when we had the discussion about women's participation in governance, and we talked about quotas for women. And initially, there was a lot of resistance. And, you know, this is not our culture, and this is not something that necessarily should be accepted. And I said, well, I mean, given the data, there are more women in your population than men. And at the end of the day, you're talking about building peace. And how can you say that they don't have a legitimate right to be part of this process if you want to build an inclusive society? And that's how come we got to the agreement that there would be a woman vice president among all the additional vice presidents that they wanted to nominate, and how they got to that arrangement on having 5 vice presidents is another story, perhaps for another day. But you know, the insistence or the mediation was that, well, okay, if you're going to have that many, one of them must be a woman, because there must be a woman in a senior leadership position.
This is such a heartwarming story. And I love how you've explained really the kind of the formal peace process and opening up the space and really giving the platform to different actors to voice their solutions and what they want to promote. Do you think it was your gender that allowed this? What do you think were the kind of the enabling factors that made you really push to ask those extra questions?
Maybe it was my gender, but also because I thought that these were issues that should not be dismissed. And also because I have, you know, seen and been part of meetings where senior male colleagues, and this is not in the United Nations, this is before I joined the United Nations, where senior male colleagues, and I'm talking about from my career as a young lawyer all the way to my career in politics, would suggest that you didn't have a point to be made, or if you were saying something, it wasn't something that was useful or that anybody should be interested in that particular, as if it wasn't relevant. And I felt that the reason why all of these women were invited to be part of the process was precisely because their voices are also relevant. And so it was important to make sure that they got the chance to also say what they wanted to say and at the same time put their points across. And I remember sometimes when I used to give the floor to Madame Rebecca Nyandeng, the widow of John Garang, who is now the female vice president, she would come up with issues about exactly how women and children and people in the protection of civilians compounds were struggling and the stresses that they went through. And very often the comments that she was making in the mediation process were snickered at, or, you know, there would be an effort to try and diminish her contribution. And I would say, no, we have to listen to her and let her make her point. And even though the reaction was not great initially, the fact of the matter is that as more and more of those remarks, suggestions, contributions were made by women on the floor, you realize that it got to a point where the men realized that they had no choice but to listen. And I think that it is important when you know that you've had certain experiences yourself and you can see when it's happening to others, that you give the opportunity, if you can, if you have the power and the authority to do so, for them to also be heard.
I couldn't agree more. That kind of role of the trailblazer, I think, is so important. I'm just going to ask one more question on the actual WPS agenda and the opportunities of the WPS agenda. And I'm sure Martin has further questions on this. But I wanted to ask a very general question. So based on your extensive experience, where does the Women, Peace and Security agenda stand 20 years after the adoption of the Security Council Resolution 1325?
It's made progress, but not fast enough. I mean, that would be my short answer. So when I joined UNOAU, one of the things that I agreed to work on with the AU in order to, as it were, commemorate the 20th anniversary of the Women, Peace and Security Agenda was on the development of a book called She Stands for Peace. And what we wanted to do was to get as many stories as possible from women who had actually been involved in the peace and security process and people who had been involved in mediations, whether it was at the community level or whether it was at a much higher level, and women who had actually made the process of mediation and peace building their major activity, to sort of have a sense of exactly how far we had come as regards the Women, Peace and Security Agenda. Now, it took a lot of effort, and we ended up having 20 stories of women who were both involved as individuals in mediation processes, but at the same time, women who were part of women's groups and who were also involved in mediation processes. And what struck me was that in many of the instances, it was simply because, especially where the women were individuals, that, you know, it wasn't as if there was the opportunity for them. They just saw crisis around themselves. They felt moved to be able to do something about it. And they just went out and organized with whatever little resources they managed to get for themselves and then did what they could to get things done. And I was struck by their ingenuity and at the same time by their resourcefulness, because there were so many of them who, as I said, they started this process virtually out of nothing, but still managed to make an impact. And when I'm talking about, for instance, going back to South Sudan, there was this lady called Davidika, I think that was her name, Ayahu. And she decided that she was going to be involved in community peace building efforts. And she did all kinds of things. I mean, she did community mediations. She also did a radio show. When she was also a refugee at some point, she was mistreated as a refugee. And so she also felt very strongly that it was important for women to be, for them to be able to get back to their home and at the same time to build peace within their home. And the amount of effort that she put in these community mediation activities, working with up to about 2,000 people, was, as far as I'm concerned, quite amazing. But when we were looking for these stories, what we found was that it was really difficult to find the stories. And another thing was, with most of the women, even though, you know, people had nominated, and most of them didn't nominate themselves, other people nominated them for the book. Even though other people had nominated them and had spoken about the work that they were doing, they were very reluctant to talk about themselves as main actors. You know, it was always about we, and we did this, and we did, you know, referring to whatever community or group that they were working in, and really didn't want to take credit for themselves. And so I think that there's a lot more work that needs to be done to document the efforts of these women, who I'm sure are not just on the continent of Africa, but all over the world, who are actively involved, but who are very self-effacing and whose experiences we haven't learned enough from. And, you know, see how we can translate that and learn and build on that and help to include more women actively in peace processes and peace building than has been the case already. Now, the African Union is trying to do this with the training of FemWise mediators. So they actually have a cohort of women mediators who can be deployed in conflict settings and help to facilitate local peace building efforts, which I think is very good and which is something that my office is supporting. But I'm sure that aside of what is happening with FemWise, looking at what happened when we were working on the book, that we might find thousands of other women who have never put themselves out there to try and talk about the things they have done, or to even think about what they are doing as part of the participation of women in peace and security, but just want to build better communities and are doing what they can to work at it. So again, that's why I said the short answer is that, you know, there hasn't been enough. The long answer, which was quite long, is that I think that there's much more that we can do to encourage their participation in these processes. And when you look at, again, on the African continent, there are not that many member states, well, let's say about half of the states on the continent, that actually have national action plans to localize the implementation of the Women, Peace and Security agenda. And interestingly enough, we find that a number of the countries where there still exists, you know, significant tensions today have not really taken steps to be able to develop their own national action plans to instrumentalize the Women, Peace and Security agenda. So I think that's something that we need to do more advocacy for, to get member states to focus on that.
These are fascinating stories, and it's great to hear how the African Union and the UN have been working together to make women perspectives matter. I would be curious to hear your thoughts on some kind of idea scenarios when it comes to conflict prevention. In your experience, what role can women play in preventing the escalation of political tensions?
Well, I think that there's, on the African continent at least, I think that elections, even though we have many more countries that are democratic and go through the process of choosing their leadership through a process of elections, the fact of the matter is that elections are seen as a very strong contestation for power, and therefore they are also events that can trigger violence and sometimes conflict. And therefore the work around elections, I think, is very important on the prevention agenda. And it would be much more useful, I think, to be able to include and involve women from the different political entities, but at the same time from civil society, when I say civil society, I mean local non-governmental organizations, but I also think about private sector, business associations, academia, and so on, and have them involved in the process of the preparation towards election and continuing to emphasize the need for the election to focus on issues, not on personalities, not on ethnic divisions, but at the same time on how whoever is contesting for political leadership can demonstrate that they actually have plans to deliver a better life for the peoples of the country. And by taking away the ethnicity issue, which in Africa is a very divisive issue, from the discussion on elections and focusing more on issue-based politics, which isn't always the case, and having more women actively involved in that process. So not just as campaigning as candidates, even though I think that there's the need to have many more women in leadership, but women who are helping others and the wider community to focus on why the election is important and speaking about the need to make sure that the election, even though it's a contestation for power, should not lead down to the breaking up of their society or increased conflict, I think would be incredibly useful in a number of member states that have committed themselves to electoral processes, but sometimes use electoral processes as a means of, as it were, presenting themselves as legitimate leaders, as opposed to really having an electoral contest where the candidate or the party that is most attractive to the electorate would actually win.
You are in Addis and we're in New York, and one thing that connects both places is not just the internet and virtual conversations like this one, but also the global health crisis, COVID-19. The Secretary General recently released a report in which he highlights the particular impact of the pandemic on women. I'm wondering which obstacles or even opportunities you see for the implementation of the Women, Peace and Security agenda in light of this global health crisis.
I think that the COVID pandemic has created some difficulty, especially to actually make concrete progress in areas where we know that there is still quite a bit of peace building to be done. And on the African continent, that's because there aren't really that many people who have access to digital technologies the way we do. And even if they did, might not necessarily see engaging on those platforms as an appropriate way of resolving whatever issues need to be addressed in the process of peace building. And so it's all well and good for us to be able to do this among representatives of states and representatives of organizations and have formal consultations and meetings, whether it's over Zoom or Teams or any other platform. But when you are talking about challenges with communities and peace building efforts in communities where we don't have access to the same kind of technology, I think it makes it more difficult. So what's happening is that What has happened over the last couple of months is that you see that the AU envoy on women, peace and security has been quite proactive in organizing these online meetings to discuss the challenges that women face. But even though through those meetings, highlight the issues of women and their vulnerabilities have been highlighted, and the need to continue to include them in these peace processes have also been highlighted. Moving from those discussions to concrete actions has been an area where we haven't made as much progress. And so quite frankly, I think that COVID has become an inhibitor to the progress that we were making on these issues.
Thank you. If I can kind of take the last section of this interview to focus on the future and aspirational aspects. And we're going to ask you some quite aspirational questions. And the first one is, if you could look at any data on WPS, women, peace and security issues, what would they be?
I would look at the number of women and young people who have been involved in community engagement on peace and security and peace building. I would look to find the data on women who have actively been involved, not just in mediation processes, but in the implementation of those agreements. I would look to see at track one level mediation activities, how many women actively were involved and had a major role to play in crafting whatever came out as a consensual agreement to be able to deal with the political challenges and to suggest solutions. And I would also look at data on how many women have been involved, actively involved in the planning and preparation of such mediation activities. I would look at the data on women who are actively involved in peacekeeping missions, when I'm talking about troop contributing countries and the contingents. And I would look to try and understand what difference having that many women as part of TCCs has actually made on the efforts at restoring peace and security in those countries, and what improvements need to be made in order to facilitate the greater participation of women in a military or police contingents in TCCs, in order to have not just the people who have been affected by conflict, to have women adequately represented in the groups of people affected by conflict, but also to ensure that women are adequately represented in those who are actively working within communities on behalf of organizations like the United Nations or the African Union and other organizations, to see how they have, what kind of positions they've been put in, and how that has made a difference to the actual peace building process.
And I think you have talked about this and you've mentioned this in your answer, but what does meaningful participation of women mean to you in one sentence in the case of Africa?
That their voices are heard, that their opinions are respected, their suggestions are considered, and when found to be relevant, included in whatever outcomes are developed.
And Hannah, what could men do specifically to contribute to this?
What can men do? What would they be willing to do? In the first instance, I would say that it's important that men recognize that women's opinions are also well-informed, are based on experience, can be useful, and can help to solve problems. And that there's not just one perspective from which you can look at an issue. There are always multiple perspectives, and therefore it's useful to have the opinion of women. It's also useful to have the opinions of our young people who also are claiming their space in order to make sure that whatever outcome is arrived at is something that is balanced and acceptable to all.
Thank you. And what sort of developments do you hope to see for the WPS agenda in the future?
I hope to see many more women in leadership positions leading mediation processes. I hope to see many more women participating actively in mediation processes, and I hope to see many more women involved, not just in participating in those processes, but in the follow-up actions that are necessary, follow-up actions and activities that are necessary to consolidate peace. And I would like to see many more women in political leadership, because it's also much easier to be able, well, not much easier, but certainly easier to be able to have women's voices heard when they are sitting in leadership positions at the table, and when they have arrived at those positions by virtue of their own merit. And I say that because, especially as multilateral organizations like the United Nations continue to emphasize the need for gender equality and for equality of opportunities, I have the suspicion that sometimes efforts at creating a certain gender balance are based more on tokenism than on substance. And so it's not just important that they should be there, but they should be there and they should know what they are doing and they can make a useful contribution.
Thanks for listening to this episode with Hannah Tette, the Secretary General's Special Representative to the African Union. If you like this series, keep listening to more interviews on women in peacemaking. Until next time.